You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another podcast episode. So today I'm starting a new series here with Mark Cunningham and Daniel Pershaw of Grace Property Management and Real Estate. They've both been on the podcast before. They are very knowledgeable. They're great property managers. So I said, hey, guys, could we start a quarterly segment where we get together every few months and from your perspective of where you see things in the market, talk about rents, what's going on, and just those fun anecdotal stories that you get from just working day to day. So this will be the first episode of hopefully many more episodes. So Mark, Daniel, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Chris. We're excited to be participating with you.
Chris, good to see you again. Thanks.
And just so everyone knows your voice, this is Mark. Say hi.
Hi, this is Mark Cunningham.
And Daniel.
And this is Daniel Pershaw.
Great. So I know we in our outline, Daniel, we talked about starting off with a rental market update. And why don't we start there, guys? When you guys want to jump in there?
Yeah, I'll let Mark kind of discuss the market update and kind of the same things that we're seeing here in Denver.
Yeah, so we're recording this here the first week of May, where we're at right now. So first quarter has been hotter than we thought it was going to be. Let me take a half step backwards. So we've been in property management since 1978. We manage upwards of 800 rental properties, commercial, residential. So we're kind of on the front lines of the market. So when stats come out, we find ourselves either agreeing with those or saying, well, that's not what we're seeing from our side of things because we're doing this stuff every day. So if we look back in the first quarter, we anticipated it to be a little bit slower than it actually was simply because the end of 2017 did slow more than we thought it was going to. And we thought that would carry over into 2018 a little bit, but it has not. So 2018 has picked right back up where the spring and summer of 2017 left us.
So did 2017 slow down? Was that due to just the seasonality or just the year overall?
It always slows a little bit because of seasonality, but last year slowed more so than the last several years before that, prior to that. And so we thought finally the market was going to flatten a little bit. We're going to get back to normal. Well, thus far, that has not been the case. Demand for rentals has just continued and even increased on the pace for all types of properties. Now, we do segment the market a little bit into downtown Denver and everywhere else. So when people use the terminology Denver, I think it's important to separate, are we talking downtown or are we talking the suburbs and really everywhere else? Because downtown is a bubble.
And when you say downtown, what's the perimeter you're talking about?
Union Station, if you can see Coors Field, you're downtown.
Okay.
If you're around a skyscraper, if you can see a crane up, that's kind of that area. Because downtown is building a lot. And so that demand that I just said is so crazy hot, not quite the case in downtown. Downtown is building a lot of new multifamily class A properties. So rental rates downtown are flat. Rental concessions are popping up like they have not in the past number of years. So free rent, reduced security deposit, all sorts of incentives are coming up because there's a lot of vacancy downtown.
And when was the last time you've seen concessions like that? Just so for some context.
It's probably been a good 6 years since we've seen any type of rental concessions in the market at all. So downtown is a little unique that way. Everywhere else, rental rates are continuing to climb. Demand is continuing to climb. It's looking like it's going to be a fabulous year for investors to, if they have a turnover, to bump up their rental rate, or if they're just doing a lease renewal, to at least have some type of a moderate rent increase with their tenant because they're going to be able to get that.
So are you kind of expecting kind of like about the same increase we've seen the last couple of years?
Yeah, we are. We thought the rental increase rate would decline, but that's not the case. So thus far, again, this is not downtown, but in single families, we're seeing 5 to 6% rent increases at a minimum on our properties. And that's after several years of 6, 7, 8, 9% rent increases.
Okay, so just business as usual, huh?
It is.
Now, what about the different types of properties? I know in the past we've talked about, condos and townhomes with all the cranes going up. What are you seeing in the different property types out there? Is it all across the board or some segments are slowing down?
The segments that are slowing are the condo and town, especially the condos, but the condo townhome segment, see, that competes with all this new construction downtown. So even if you've got a condo in Aurora, in Thornton, in Wheat Ridge, if you're a tenant and you're looking to rent a condo, that's the price range you're in, and you see these incentives offered downtown, which is brand new construction, high rise, dog walking facility, pool, park, you know, everything that they're building into these things, no security deposit, first month's rent, you'll gladly move a little bit further out of the Wheat Ridge or Thornton area to get that property downtown. So suddenly now, even if you have a vacant condo in Thornton, you are in essence competing with the downtown market because they're drawing tenants to the downtown with their great deals.
Now, this might be a hard question for you to answer, but you know, as you know, Charles Roberts, he loves Section 8. A lot of the clients we work with, they do a lot of, you know, Section 8 rentals. Is that part of the market getting drawn into downtown as well? Or do you have enough data to even be able to begin to answer that question?
From a data standpoint, I don't know if I could give a solid answer. From what we're seeing, yes, that is impacting that. And for the same reason, because there's all this demand. So some of these high rises, these Section 8 tenants are going after the high rise stuff. And you know, Denver had a recent episode where they're actually funding through some nonprofits. It's like a Section 8 type program for working class individuals, the teachers, the firemen. City Denver is going to kick in some rents, and these nonprofits will kick in some rents so individuals can move into properties that are basically priced too high for them, but the city is going to subsidize them.
Okay.
You know, it's capitalism turned on its head. Rather than rental rates coming down, City Denver is going to subsidize. We'll see how that turns out. But same thing on these tenants who are Section 8 tenants. Why would you go rent a what was typically a Section 8 property, right? A Class B or Class C property, because now these high rises with multiple vacancies, they're turning to Section 8 because they need to get these things filled. So Section 8 tenants have an opportunity to get into brand new Class A stuff.
I just know nothing about like that downtown market in Denver as far as rental stuff. So is it common for those new Class A bills to allow Section 8 tenants, or is that something that they're turning to because, it is
it is not common. This is the first time we've ever seen that happen. But they have so much vacancy, they can't get these things filled. And so they're really grasping at straws here to get tenants in these properties because they're priced so high from the investor standpoint that they kind of don't know what to do. But they're reaching out to get these things filled. It'll be interesting to see in the next 12 to 24 months what happens. You know, coming online, I was doing some research before we came in here. Denver, as of right now, is leading the nation in terms of new construction. Leading the nation. So, you know, is there overbuilding going on? My opinion is yes. I think we're potentially overbuilding in downtown because we don't have the demand right now for the vacancies we have. And we've gotten many, many new properties coming online in the coming year. So from an investor standpoint, we're not recommending our investors buy downtown. I would not purchase downtown. I'd be looking in the suburbs, not condos, not townhomes, and definitely not downtown. That's
okay,
our recommendation.
So pushing out from the downtown bubble and now going out to the suburbs, what are you seeing out there now?
Demand for single family is at a record high.
So and when you say single family, you mean like a home?
Single family homes, yes.
Okay.
If you're an investor and you came into our office and said, hey, what should I buy? We would recommend going out and getting the 3-bed, 2-bath home in the suburbs. Demand for those types of properties is at an all-time high. That's what tenants want. They're not moving nearly as much as people would move out of a condo or townhome. So it's just a good long-term solid investment.
Okay. Now, I know we got a few more topics on here, and just looking at the outline we put together, anything else you want to talk about the rental market before we move on here to kind of next step?
I would just say if you're an investor and you've purchased downtown, the rental rate that you were getting last year or with your prior tenant probably has changed pretty dramatically because of rent concessions. So if your market research is telling you should be getting $1,800 a month because you got it last year, maybe you can, maybe you can't, but don't rely on prior years or even prior quarters numbers on your rental rates. You need to go out there and get a current analysis done on your property to see what it's going to rent for today because things are changing very quickly. Our market is very fluid right now.
And actually, I want to ask you about the data you mentioned where Denver is leading the nation in new construction. Is that just like total volume or is that like total new construction per capita? or do you even know?
I don't know. Okay. New construction is what the data is saying. So I don't know if it's per capita or not, though.
Okay. And you said the single family homes, like the 3-2 bread and butter homes in the suburbs, an all time high. I mean, what are you seeing there as far as just like vacancy? Or if you've got a 3-2 on the market, like how many calls you're getting, how many days of vacancy, or is it like written out the minute it's put on the market?
It's in essence a 0% vacancy rate on single family. And if we compare that to what we've just been talking about with multifamily, it makes sense. What is being built right now? Multifamily is being built. There's very little new construction coming on the market for single family homes. So the demand, although the demand is increasing, there's no new supply or very little supply. So we have investors, for example, that are out there buying brand new Class A single family homes. You know, they're out there paying close to $500,000 on these things to convert to a rental. Now, when you run the numbers, they don't make sense. But the numbers from an investor standpoint on your return, on your cap rate. But if it's a long-term play and if you want to get a good quality tenant in place, then that's not a bad place to, from a safety aspect, we believe, of putting your money. But if you've got a vacancy, a single family vacant property, and it's priced appropriately, it's going to go immediately.
Well, you got me, my interest peaked now. So for that $500,000 new build, like what areas are you talking about that people are actually buying those?
We're seeing a lot of those in the North Thornton area.
Okay.
In the Broomfield area, you know, things continue to grow north down the I-25 corridor. There's been a newer Amazon facility that popped up there on 144th. Mm-hmm. That's drawing a lot of single family in. And what we like about that in this north corridor with the growth is happening first around industrial, retail, jobs. So the jobs are coming in first, you know, like look at the Amazon Center, then the houses are following, which is exactly what you want in the ideal scenario. Rather than going out and just building a bunch of homes and waiting for the infrastructure to come afterwards, they've been doing the infrastructure first and the homes will follow. So there's a new demand for these types of properties.
New Commerce City is another area that we see a lot of new development and single family homes being built out. So we've had several investors recently that we've worked with who've purchased homes over there in the Reunion area or closer, maybe even further west toward the Highway 85, 104th Ave intersection. And so we've leased several properties in that area, Turnberry. So we're definitely seeing development up here in the northern region. So, you know, and one thing I wanted to add to the previous conversation about the multifamily development is, you know, more statistics that we've seen recently show that there's about 20,000 units under construction in the Denver market. And that's that downtown Class A multifamily stuff that's being built out. And then, you know, what's happening now is the developers are seeing that and maybe that oversaturation, they're pushing out into the outlying areas to build more multifamily. So, you know, we just read an article about Arvada and 1,500 units going in there close to the light rail stations, which is, you know, going to bring people down into Denver quicker. And that's the article that I referenced is, you know, they're basically saying that those developers are concerned about that saturation. So
let me ask you guys both this. So for those, Danny, you just mentioned in New Commerce City, some new developments, like just rough numbers. What does a house sell for over there and what are the rents like?
So the new build, the new development stuff that's going up is, you know, I think you could purchase a new single family home, 3-bed, 2-bath for somewhere in the high 300s, 375, maybe low 400s by now. But those are leasing somewhere in the $2,200 to $2,400 a month range, but they're nice. They have nice finishes. They've got granite and stainless, and it's a brand new construction. So, you know, from a square footage standpoint, that's probably a 1,700 square foot house finished with an unfinished basement.
Okay. And Mark, you talked about, you know, $500,000 properties, just rough rental numbers on someone buys a place like that. What type of return are they getting?
They're going for about $3,500 a month on average. So the rate of return on a cap rate is terrible.
But like, I think, do you know what it would be just off the top of your head? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah,
here.
Daniel, you know, have you calculated those out?
I haven't, but if I were to guess, it has to be pretty low. I'd say somewhere in the 4 to 4.5% range.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things we recommend to investors on those things as well, the benefit on you're getting on that new single family is your maintenance cost is going to be zero, because we see investors miscalculate that when they're running numbers on investment property. If you're buying an older property, you are going to have maintenance expense. We just saw, there was just a report released about 2 weeks ago on American Homes for Rent, the publicly traded stock, and they missed their numbers. and they missed their numbers in a big way. Their stock was hit. And what the article said is they miscalculated maintenance. And they miscalculated maintenance. They had calculated a 6% or a 5.5% maintenance expense. So it was an interesting article because what we always recommend, and we've been saying this for 40 years, when you're trying to budget a dollar expense for maintenance, you want to budget about 1 month worth of rent for maintenance. Mm-hmm. Meaning if your property is running for $1,000 a month and you want to budget for how much am I going to spend this year on maintenance, I'd budget $1,000. Now it's going to waver a little bit. Some months or some years may be higher, some years it may be lower, but that's a pretty good baseline to start with. And what American Homes for Rent found is they missed their numbers and all their accountants missed it and they didn't know what they did wrong. If you would have taken 1 month worth of vacancy, that would equate to 8% of your gross annual income. Right, 12 months if you do the math. So yep. 8%. Well, what they said is, gosh, we missed our numbers. Rates are down because our actual maintenance was 8.2%.
Really?
Yeah. So if I'll toot our horn here for a minute, right? I mean, if they would have called us or called any property management company would have said, on average, for a portfolio, you want to budget 8%, or I think it's 8.2%, because that's going to be 1 month worth of maintenance on average over the course of time for any portfolio. So even American Homes for Rent budgeted low on maintenance. And it's very, very common for investors to do that. So don't do that. You want to assume you're going to have maintenance expenses probably higher than you think on most of your investment properties.
So I want to dive into these numbers here just because I'm very interested by it. I mean, so you're talking here, you know, Daniel, you were saying, I'll just say $400,000-ish for $2,200 to $2,400 rent per month. Mark, you're saying $500,000, about $3,500 a month. Would either of these properties be considered like luxury? Because I know the luxury stuff in downtown has just been getting not doing too well the last couple of years from a rental standpoint. I'm just trying to get a perspective as to like where they fit in the market here.
I would say luxury would probably be maybe even one step up from what Mark mentioned. You know, we have some investors who own homes in the North Broomfield market, or they're $600,000-$700,000 homes, and really, in our opinion, probably bad rental properties. But maybe they've owned them for several years, they have a good equity position, and so they hang on to them. But that luxury market is challenging, definitely, because the homes are going to sit on the market longer. You have limited demand. If you're put yourself in that situation, and can you spend $3,500 or $4,000 a month to lease one of these properties out? It's tough.
Yeah. So walk me through then, just to play devil's advocate now, because we can go out and buy a condo in Aurora for $200,000, $220,000, rent it out for $1,800 a month. So better cash flow to price ratio there. Go into more of the thinking of the numbers with these new build single family homes, the numbers behind them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me push back on what you just said.
Yeah.
If you came to me today and said you can buy the property, how much are you going to pay for the property with the numbers you just gave me, Chris?
I mean, 200 to 230.
Okay. And you're going to rent it for what?
Say 1800.
For 1800. I think that's going to be a challenge in today's market, because for 1800 bucks, you can also go downtown and get the brand new Class A. And the property you're going to be purchasing for 200 is not going to be Class A.
But are those like three bedroom, two bath Class A properties downtown?
They're one or two. But when you go in and buy this unit that you're talking about, I'm guessing the amenities of this unit are pretty basic.
They're nothing like the downtown
stuff.
No, I mean, yeah.
So you're throwing in, you're now the tenant who you were trying to appeal to now has 20,000 downtown Denver properties that are competing for them. And all those properties are offering amenities that are ridiculous, that you can't compete with. So that rental rate, you're going to see declining, or you're going to see some concessions thrown in, or you're going to see it sitting vacant. So I would push back a little bit on getting those numbers that you just talked about.
Okay.
And maybe you can get them today, but every month it gets harder and harder and harder, because every month the new open for business sign pops up in the downtown high rise kind of a thing. Whereas the single family, if running the numbers, the property's going to rent on day one, you're not going to have the turnover you have in the downtown market, because it's just a different segment of the market. That's just, it's a more transient market.
Yeah.
Any type of property is. So over the course of time, if you're a long-term investor, and you're also going to appreciate a lot more on the single family, historically speaking. So it depends. If you're pure on cash flow, I just want to cash flow play, then yes, go downtown and you're going to get a higher return on your money, a higher cap rate. If it's more of a buy and hold long term, I want to get something that's going to appreciate and I don't want to have the headaches of management as much, then you probably want to consider the single family.
Okay. And you even think that, like, because, you know, we buy quite a few like 3-bedroom or 4-bedroom condos, townhomes, South Aurora. And even those 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom condos are getting the pressure from the new stuff downtown, do you know? And I'm getting very granular here.
Yeah, I don't really, know.
Really,
I don't
like,
know.
I like picking your guys' brain.
Yeah, I don't know if they're feeling the pressure yet or not, but it's starting. I mean, it's starting with the typical condos, and it's going to continue on. It's not showing any sign of slowing down. With this many new properties coming on the market in the next 12 months, I mean, you know, I'll ask you, what do you think that's going to do to your property when you're now competing with 22,000 brand new units that just popped on the market? And some are one bed, some are two, some are three. Who knows what they are?
Yeah.
But again, they're Class A, their amenities are rich. And the owners of these properties, we're talking insurance companies, you know, we're talking mutual fund companies. That means they've got deep pockets. So they can offer deep discounts that you probably can't do really to compete.
Yeah, I can't match those mutual funds quite yet.
Not quite yet.
Piggy bank. So
that's the challenge. I mean, philosophically, we encourage our investors to think through whether you want to get a good property at a great price, mm-hmm. or do you want a great property at a good price?
Sounds like a Warren Buffett quote to me almost. I don't know if you're familiar
I don't think I stole it from him, yeah. But maybe I did. I don't know.
No, I think that's actually my favorite quote. It's one of his quotes, and I'm going to butcher it, but it's, you know, it's better to buy a great company at a fair price rather than a fair company at a great price.
Yeah.
So I see similarities there in what you and Mr. Buffett are saying. So my kind of final question on this rental market update section of things is just, I know, Mark, you've been in the business for a long time and you grew up in this business. At this point, with the way just the market looks, the rental market, the growth, supply and demand, has this paralleled anything you've seen in the past, just, you know, last 30, 40 years that you can remember, just rough like periods in time, just from an anecdotal standpoint or just, you know, being a boots on the ground?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we saw this before the big market crash in the 80s. Now, I don't think we're heading to a market crash. You know, the things that were in place at that point in time were a little bit unique with the SNL and the tax reform at that point in time. So that was a odd series of events. But at that point in time, before we hit that, and this is, you know, this is dating ourselves in the Denver area, but this is back when oil was a big contributor to our economy here. Yeah, we saw the same type of thing before we fell off the cliff at that point in time. Now, our opinion is not that we're about to crash.
Yeah.
I think hopefully we'll slow down a little bit. We kind of need to, but things continue to look very, very strong in our opinion.
So looking at the next thing on our agenda, I know we'd outlined for some like new and noteworthy topics. So Daniel, take it away.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a couple of things I wanted to mention and just kind of talk a little bit about. And these are items that we've had firsthand experience with. So that's why I want to bring them up. And hopefully we can help the investor group that's listening today and, you know, give them a few tips. But both of these items, the first thing is called pay range. And it's something that we stumbled across not too long ago. It's a laundry operations program. And we took over a mini multifamily property down in Glendale not too long ago. And we had the idea of, you know, we needed to get the property performing and include some amenities and clean things up. It was not performing at the time we took it over, which was toward the beginning of February. But we've since stabilized the property. Everything's running well. And one of the things we implemented was a new laundry system, new laundry machines, brand new Maytag. And something that we implemented in them was a system called Pay Range. And Pay Range is essentially, it's comprised of two components, which one is a blue key is what they call it. And it's a device that installs into the laundry machine itself. And then the second is the Pay Range mobile app. So what it is this is just it's a mobile pay system. And it operates through a cloud-based platform. And that's kind of what separates the customer, the consumer that's standing there paying for laundry services, and then the operator, which in this case is us as the property management company.
So I want to ask you a couple of questions here before you go on. So, I mean, I've definitely used, you know, hey, you put your three quarters in and slide it and you rack it. So that's been removed. And now this, what you're calling this blue key, you said that's kind of like where the coin slot used to be, or are both still there, the coin and the mobile pay?
So you can do it either way. The commercial laundry company that we used gave us two options. They said you can either use the PayRange mobile feature exclusively, or we can implement and set it up to where you have coin-operated use and mobile pay through PayRange. And so, you know, the property that we were managing, we didn't want to lose income from the current residents that were there. The former machines that we had in there were coin machines. Mm-hmm. And so we went ahead and implemented the coin plus PayRange option, and it's been working really well. But what's neat about it is everything is through this PayRange platform, so I can track it. I can see what percentage of residents are using mobile pay versus coins.
What is a percentage?
About 60%.
60% are using the mobile wireless pay.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So about 60% are, at least at this point, we've only had it implemented for a couple of months. So we're still kind of monitoring it and see how the tenants are using it. But it's been really interesting though. And it's just another way to make things easy for the residents. And I think that's the biggest point to take away is that if you can implement something that's easy to use for the residents and then also easy for you as the manager of the property, then you know it definitely adds value.
And so what are the fees? Like what's the fee to install it and what's their monthly? I'm sure they're taking a couple points every transaction, right? Like what's the fees look like?
The fee structure is very, very small. I don't recall the exact dollar amount, but it ended up on our transactions, which average about $1.50 per wash or per dry. I think that PayRange collects 8 cents. So I don't know what the percentage of that is, but pretty nominal, very nominal. You do pay a flat fee at the front end for the device, the PayRange device.
Like a one-time setup fee or something?
Exactly. So when you purchase the machine, the vendor, the company that's selling you the machine can also sell you the device to be installed inside of it. And you pay basically a flat fee for that. And then you pay a transaction fee thereafter. So it's pretty slick. But we're able to monitor the usage, monitor how people like it. You know, it gives us weekly reports. So it's just really easy to use. And it's a big deal, I think, for a lot of the residents. We got a lot of really good feedback from the people that were living there just saying, this is great. I don't have to carry quarters around. It's just, it's been great.
And so, how many units are at this property? You said it was a small multi, but five units, 20 units?
This is 30 units.
Okay. So it's a good size property.
Yeah, it's a pretty good size property, but there are... it's competing with a lot of bigger properties, especially in that specific submarket. So
this is something that can be really incorporated into even a fourplex. You know, I mean, in smaller investors that have small multifamily with a laundry facility, coin operated system is just, it's outdated. And if you're trying to compete with some of the amenities that we've been talking about, this is a great way to do it.
Well, plus I'm assuming you no longer have to go there and collect the quarters every couple of weeks because it's probably all just transferred to you via PayPal or ACH or something, right?
The quarters, because we kept the coin-operated structure, we do still have to go get quarters, which is, you know, inconvenient sometimes. But what's neat about it is we know when we need to go get the quarters, because typically, you know, you just go down there and you empty the quarter box occasionally when you think it needs it. But in this, with PayRange, it tracks the cash transactions. So you can look at each machine and say, okay, machine number one has $250 of quarters inside of it. So it's about time I need to go collect. Oh. So it's pretty slick. So you can see the reporting on that side as well.
And so this can be, do you have to buy a new washing and drying machine, or can you modify an existing, you know, older washer and dryer that's already out there?
I don't know the exact answer to that, to be honest with you. We purchased new machines and that's how we found out about PayRange. I would imagine that it would implement into any other newer machine, but it installs into the payment system somehow right there. So, you know, I'll leave that up to the investors to look into.
I guess they can spend 3 minutes on Google.
Yeah, that's right.
So they would just Google, I mean, it's PayRange, like PayRange.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Great.
So we've liked that a lot. One other thing I wanted to bring up was a company called Amenify. And we found out about this company not too long ago through an article in the Rental Housing Journal. And Amenify is a private company that has recently partnered with a big multifamily apartment provider in the downtown area. And what they're doing is they're targeting the multifamily properties that aren't brand new construction that might not have the amenities that are being built into them. So these brand new Class A downtown units that we're talking about are being built with, you know, gyms and coffee shops and all the amenities that people want. Amenify is a company that's coming in to help the other side of the multifamily market, the 30 unit buildings, to attract those residents. So Amenify is coming in and they're saying, hey, owners or landlords, why don't we provide a service to you where you can offer to your residents dog walking services and personal training and cleaning services. So what they're doing is Amenify is running that project or that offering to the residents to help those properties compete against these big Class A units.
And so this sounds like it's more for service-based stuff. They're not coming in and like remodeling the lounge into a gym. They're just offering like the concierge type service and coordinating it.
Correct. Yeah. It's,
okay.
For the industry expert, it's called a soft amenity. So it's a, you know, those hard amenities like the fitness clubs and things like that would be what you're talking about. These are more services. So it is exactly those things that I mentioned is they're doing dog walking. So they'll come weekly or, you know, however often that the agreement is set up and walk the residents' dogs or give them personal training. So it's pretty cool. It's a great idea. And we've considered using it or have at least proposed it to some of the owners of larger multifamily properties that we manage and may implement it at some time.
So soft amenity and hard amenity, that's like the jargon that they use out there for
apparently
that?
That's the jargon.
I learned something new today. All right,
there you go.
My vocabulary today. So I'm assuming Amenify, it sounds like it's a new trendy app that people just download from the app store and it's spelled the new way where they're mixing up vowels to make it short, right? Like, so it's just like an all app-based thing that people are using?
I don't know if it's an app, actually. I think it's just a software that plugs into... It's a service software that plugs into the property manager software, the owner software. So, you know, like we use AppFolio, which is our management software, and Amenify creates some type of program that kind of integrates into that. And so they run the system, and then through that, they're able to give these offerings to the residents.
So how, because this is more just me asking, I love technology, like how does the consumer, the tenant, how do they get connected? I mean, how are they going through then your portal on your website to schedule? Is that all integrated into there?
I don't know on the scheduling side how the logistics work, but the offering is in the advertising process, right? So we would advertise a unit for rent. And then in that ad, we would say, okay, here's the price for the unit. Here's the details. Oh, and by the way, here are some amenities that you can choose from, either this, this, or this. And then the resident will get that for free for the first 6 months or for the first year. And that's how we would be able to differentiate ourselves from those other big, big players.
Okay, that makes sense.
So Chris, let's go back to your condo that you brought up earlier, right? Your $200,000 condo for $1,800 that I just told you you're not going to be able to get rented. Well, you use a company like Amenify, and now you can compete with those big boys because now in your ad, you can say, hey, when you rent my property, I'm going to give you pickup and delivery of your laundry for dry cleaning. And then we're going to have a dog walking service and we're going to have food delivery. So now suddenly you're able to compete with those big boys that are already offering these amenities. You as the landlord are paying for it, but your tenant is benefiting and you're able to compete at a different level that you were not able to do before. That's the idea behind this.
So this can be used by all states, you know, small mom and pop investors, not just...
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It's very much for the small mom and pop investors.
Okay. And then, so I'm assuming then that the owner is absorbing that cost. They're paying the extra, I mean, so many dollars a month. But then if the person wants a dog walking, they're paying, who's paying for that dog walk? Is it actually the owner paying for it or is it the tenant paying
The owner typically offers it. So the owner's going to pay X number of dollars per month to Amenify for this service. And therefore the tenant, I'm just making this up here, but therefore the tenant will be allowed to contact them and get, you know, two dog walkings a week or whatever it's going to be. So the owner's paying for it, tenant gets to benefit from the service.
And so really, so it's basically like the owner's paying for it regardless of if the tenants are using it or not.
I don't know that level of detail, okay. but it's coming out of the owner's pocket. I mean, the concession, it's a rent concession is in essence what it is. So you're paying this as an offering to your tenant. But in the market we're in right now, I think this is going to be a very good way for some of those mom and pop owners of small multifamily or condos to compete with other folks.
I'm going to have to look into that more. And so, Daniel, just to make sure we got the spelling right, it's Amenify, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
So, and it does sound like they do all of the work. Amenify does all the work in terms of communicating and coordinating the services with the residents. They also vet the service providers as well. So if they're hiring or if they're going to provide the dog walking service, they're vetting those dog walking companies, making sure they're quality organizations and are insured, et cetera. So that's kind of their ad is they you offer the amenity and they facilitate it.
Now, is there, and you guys may not know this, but is there any space for this in like just single family homes or landlords or your clients offering that on the home side? Or is there ever a play for that, do you think? Just curiosity, big picture.
I think that we're going to see more companies like this, like Amenify, come and try to do what they're doing. They kind of advertise themselves as a marketplace for these services for apartment buildings. So I could definitely see a company coming in, though, similar to them, if they don't already do it, to cater to the smaller single family home owners to help them differentiate themselves.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, right now, the market for single family rentals is so hot that we don't need to offer amenities. But if that market slowed down, by all means, I mean, we'll offer dog walking, we'll offer whatever it's going to take to get a rental rented if the market were to slow to that point.
So changing topics here, I know we've talked about this in the past, Mark, but this topic comes up all the time as we talk to clients. It comes up all the time in classes. Should investors allow pets?
Short answer is, in our opinion, yes. Yes, they should. So a couple of things to keep in mind. If you say no to pets, you know, what does that mean? Well, 65% of tenants come with pets. 65%. So what that means is if you're saying, hey, I'm a landlord and I do not want any pets on my rental property, that's fine. You can say that legally, but you have just turned away 65% of your potential clients. The potential market you have is now only 35% of the full market. So you're dealing with a much smaller clientele base, which means it's going to take you a little bit longer to rent your property. Now, if it's a single family home, again, the market's hot, you're going to be okay. It's still going to get rented. But more and more tenants are bringing their pets with them. So you're turning away. That's a negative there. Number two negative is if you do approve a tenant with a pet, historically speaking, that tenant is going to stay longer simply because it is more difficult to go find a property that allows pets. So once they get in and you're allowing them to keep Fluffy the dog, they don't want to go find another property for Fluffy the dog.
Is there data for how much longer they stay, like on average, do you know? Like, hey, they stay, you know,
I'm sure there is
7 months longer.
No, I don't have that. I don't have that. But that's just what we see. You know, speaking from being on the front lines of this stuff, our tenants with pets move less often than tenants without them because they want to have a little home for their pet. So they move less. And as long as you restrict the pets, and by that I mean you want to restrict the breed, you want to restrict the number of pets, you want to restrict the weight. As long as you have those some basic restrictions in place, we do not see on average pets doing damage to properties.
I'm assuming pets usually mean just dogs and cats, not too many exotic animals.
Correct, dogs and cats. I mean, our recommendation is for the dog, you know, the small to medium-sized dog. Cats, we're not big fans of, simply because cats can do things to carpets that dogs can't do if they try. So as a landlord, if you're allowing cats, you're going to get that thing rented super fast because most landlords don't allow cats.
Now, I remember when you were on our podcast earlier, Daniel, you were talking about all the like the vinyl flooring that you guys are big fans of now. Is that more cat-proof, do you know? Have you seen any experiments with that yet?
Nothing's cat-proof.
Yeah. Like Mark said, we're not fans of cats. So, yeah, it scratches. So okay. I would say no, you know, cats and dogs, I guess, you know, that flooring type will scratch up a little bit and scuff. So it's not indestructible, but it's a good product and it lasts longer than carpet will.
And so going back to the dogs, you're talking about restricting the breeds. I'm assuming just the typical things, and you know, your homeowner's insurance restricts breeds on for a lot of times, the more aggressive breeds. What about weight size? You're talking 25 pounds, 50 pounds?
You can cut it off wherever you want. I mean, for us, we cut it off at, I think, 50 pounds is our typical cutoff on size type of thing. Now, everybody has their own opinions on that. So you can follow whatever rules you want to follow internally for that. But one thing to keep in mind that we tell our investors as well is look at the specifics of your property when you're deciding whether or not to allow a pet. So, for example, the brand new home we just talked about earlier, you know, $500,000, everything's new, new hardwood, new carpet. Probably don't take the pet. Mm-hmm. But let's say that tenant's in place for 2 years and they move out and now the carpet's a little bit worn and you probably only got a couple years life left in the carpet. Well, now for that same exact property, now maybe for the next tenant, you do want to allow a pet. Why? Because you know you're going to be changing the carpet out anyway at the end of that tenant. So look at the specifics of the property in its current condition to decide whether or not you want to potentially allow a pet for your current incoming tenant.
And layout as well, right? So if you have a condo unit and you have a 8x8 backyard or back patio, then it's not going to be as conducive to have a dog there as a single family home with a yard and space for those animals to move around. So,
and I've seen many 70-pound German shepherds and labs living in condos, and I get what you're saying, but it's amazed.
From the investor standpoint, you know, from a logistical standpoint, you do want to probably charge an additional security deposit for the pet. You know, quick sidebar, you don't want to call it a pet deposit. Don't charge a pet deposit, or else you can only apply it for damage done by the pet. Can't apply it for missing rent or the hole that the tenant knocked in the wall. So don't charge a pet deposit, but charge an increase in the deposit. It's not uncommon as well for landlords to charge additional rent for the pet. There may be some non-refundable pet fees, which is normal as well. And then you want to make sure you include a pet addendum to your lease, which is going to specifically state the responsibilities of the tenant as it relates to the pet. How often are they going to pick up after it? Does it have to be licensed? Do you have to get shots? So you can really restrict pets as long as you don't delve into the service animals.
And I was actually about to mention that because that's a very interesting topic. I learned actually from you a long time ago, one of your classes, Mark. For people out there, we won't dive into in this podcast, but on either one of the webinars Mark has done with us, or might be the property management 101 course on the website, he does a segment on there about service animals versus pets. Really, really good stuff to know, because I almost stepped on that, I'll see, air quotes, landmine of a problem when I was renting out property years ago, because I thought they were all the same, and I was definitely wrong. So I know we were talking, I think it was a couple days ago, as we were preparing for the call. Well, I know one of the clients you guys are working with is actually doing a pretty interesting, I think it was a 1031 from Florida is what you had mentioned. I don't want to butcher the details, but I'll let one of you guys take it away and kind of fill in what you're seeing and that story, because those stories are always so interesting to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the investor is from Florida. He flew in here probably 30 days ago, 45 days ago, and we sat down and met with him about a real estate portfolio that he has over in Florida. So he's made the decision, something about the Florida market. I don't know the Florida market well, so you know, he seemed to be pretty comfortable with the
fact. Look, I lived in Florida. It's the right move to move out of there.
Okay, there you go. There you go. So yeah, he thought the same thing. So he's made a decision to sell all the real estate that he has in Florida. He's going to 1031 into Colorado. So we sat down and met with him. And, you know, we just thought it was interesting that he chose Colorado. I think just speaks to the market that we're in, that people want to be here. They know that the market's strong. They see opportunity here. And, you know, this is not a small investor. You know, he's got, you know, several million dollars of 1031 funds that he's going to move over and purchase. And he's buying single family homes in the Thornton and Broomfield markets.
So he's buying all small stuff.
He's buying...
I say small stuff, not large multifamily.
Right, exactly, exactly. So he is coming in, he's purchasing 3-bed, 2-bath single family homes in Thornton and Broomfield. So that, from our opinion, that perfect rental property. So we thought that was pretty interesting, but we've been working with him and it's been fun to see that transition. And, you know, we were able to advise him a little bit on what type of markets we think are good and have a lot of upside from a long-term perspective.
You know, this guy lives in California, I believe, right, Daniel?
Florida.
I think he lives in California, though, doesn't he, this individual? So, you know, he lives in California, wanted to sell his Florida portfolio. And as Daniel said, he chose Colorado. So from an investor standpoint who lives in California, we are not overpriced. Mm-hmm. There's always the talk of, are we overpriced? Are we not? It's all relative. But for those West Coast investors, they're still continuing to come to Colorado and they still see us as a buying opportunity. So it's very easy for us to talk about being overpriced and, you know, they just can't keep going higher. Well, they can because they are on the coast. And so for a lot of those coast investors, we are still a great buying opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. We have a client come actually flying in from Northern California this weekend to look at properties with us for the weekend. Like, exact same thing. California investor putting his money somewhere where things actually cash flow with some money down.
And it's all about the time frame. I mean, if an investor comes to us and they say, hey, you know, I only want to hold for 24 months and then get out, well, maybe now is not the time to buy in this market. We don't know what's going to happen. But from a long-term perspective, I mean, we love the Denver market and Colorado as a whole.
So, I mean, long-term, you brought that up now. So, I mean, in 30 years, just big picture, like, where do you see things at? Just besides real estate prices and rents will be higher. Like, what do you see?
Oh, you want a 30-year projection?
No, okay. The very, like...
I just want to be clear on that.
You're bullish on, like, why? Like, give me your crystal ball here.
We met yesterday, Daniel and I did, with a gentleman who's got 19 single-family homes in the Denver market that he has acquired over the past, I don't know, 20 years or so. And he would go out, he'd find a deal, he'd buy it, he'd pay it off as quick as he could, he'd buy another one. So over the course of his life, he's acquired 20 single family properties, roughly. So from the investor's standpoint, if your time horizon is long, whether you call that 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years, and you're conservative in going and buying solid properties that are going to appreciate well, my personal opinion is, who cares what the market does? If you get those things paid down or paid off even better, and rental rates drop 10%, which is kind of what happened at the last big crash out here, well, all that meant is instead of giving $1,000 a month, you're getting $900 a month. Well, in the grand scheme of things, big deal. Like that was the crash. We went from $1,000 to $900. Mm-hmm. Most investors are able to stomach that. So if that's as bad as it's going to get, that was the crash, which we don't anticipate coming again. There is a lot of strong reasons to buy in our market. And I can't imagine that trifecta of events happening again like they did before to drive our prices down. So with that in mind, you know, do you sit on the sidelines and keep waiting and waiting and waiting for deals? We don't see the prices correcting again like they did. So I don't even think I answered your question on a 30-year forecast, but I'll just say good.
Hey, you gave me a good answer though. So yeah, I mean, I'm nodding because everyone on the podcast can see me, but I'm nodding in agreement. That makes sense to me. So I know on their outline here, we've written down FTO investments, and I have no idea what that means. So I'm intrigued. What is an FTO investment?
An FTO investment is an opportunity, I think. And actually, this is an entity that Mark and I established recently to acquire some properties. And so we recently stumbled upon a value add project up in Northern Colorado and have purchased it within the last week and are putting some money into it to resell it. So, you know, that's something I just wanted to discuss. It's kind of a fun project that we have going on.
Yeah.
But we talked a little bit about some investing that we do personally.
Is like a partnership or something between you? Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And so, you know, we found these properties actually up in the Greeley area, and that's home to me. That's where I live. So I'm fortunate because I'm familiar with the Northern Colorado market, worked in the real estate industry up there for about 7 years, finance and real estate. And then, of course, I've been with Grace. So I know getting familiar with the Denver market, North Denver market, but these are up in Greeley and they're exciting. They're good opportunities. There's two single family homes that we purchased that were owned by the same individual side by side, sitting on separate lots. And, you know, there's a lot of options there that we may entertain, but still just kind of we just purchased them last week. So making a plan to move forward. And so that's pretty exciting.
Now, is this to flip and make some money? You're going to hold on to it, like do a value add and rent it out, or is it still to be determined?
So these are some of the roughest properties I've ever seen since 1978.
I hope you guys have some photos of this now.
Oh, we took a few, I think.
I've got a video tour.
I was scared. I was scared to walk inside of one of the properties because I figured there'd be too many homeless people and living in there. We didn't find any, but you know, this is the roof is collapsing in and you got to watch where you step or you're going to step on a person or a rat or something, body. So these are rough properties. These are very rough. So our plan is to basically tear them down. And we looked at a couple options. We actually looked at combining the lots. Do we build a small multifamily and then sell that? We decided that this is kind of one we want to get in and out on quickly. So we're just going to kind of be rebuilding the existing structures, tearing them down to frames, to studs, rebuilding the existing structures to create a decent little single family home and flip them because that Greeley market just recently was tagged as one of the hottest markets for growth, I believe. One of the hottest small markets for growth in the U.S. So that Northern Colorado area is still presenting some opportunities.
Yeah, and it's stemmed by the development that's happening in Fort Collins, Loveland, Windsor, the three other major cities up in Northern Colorado. Everything is moving to the east, which is where Greeley is. And so Fort Collins is landlocked to a certain degree. There's not a lot of land left to develop. It's turning into a mini Boulder, I guess is what you could think of it as. And then the Loveland market, of course, is also restrained by the mountains to the west. So everything is growing east. And so there's a lot of development, a lot of growth potential, appreciation potential as you go east. That's just historically how things work.
And Greeley's right in the way of all that.
Greeley's right in the way of it. And that's the next major city that's, you know, still trying to catch up from a price standpoint. So I think that Greeley will have higher appreciation rates than will any other city in Northern Colorado probably this year and for maybe the next couple of years. And these properties that we purchased are actually just 4 or 5 blocks to the east of University of Northern Colorado. So it's, you know, they're accessible to UNC, they're accessible to major areas of town. And so is that the lots are zoned for a multifamily or other uses. So there's a lot of opportunity in those. And so that's why we jumped on them.
And so, I mean, just rough numbers, like what's the estimated rehab budget and what's the turnaround time? I mean, it sounds like it's a pretty, it's not just a fresh coat of paint and a new kitchen. It sounds like you got quite a bit more work to do in there.
Yeah. So there's two houses. One, the one that Mark's talking about, the one that's in teardown condition is really in teardown condition. So we've spent the last 2 days with the crew over there and they're demoing everything down, to taking all the interior walls out, taking the roof off. Everything is coming down except for the exterior studs and the slab foundation. So
wow,
we're rebuilding it from there. But I say total cost would probably be in it somewhere in the ballpark of $125,000.
For rehabbing that one property.
Correct.
That's kind of what would the cost be to rebuild it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that'll be a 600 square foot, 2-bed, 1-bath house. So it's real little. It's about the size of a postage stamp. But the prices, the ARV supports the project. So yeah. You know, we'll probably do pretty well on that one. And then the house that's next door is in a lot better condition. It's still not perfect, but, you know, we'll do some interior renovations to that one. We might put, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 into that property with a new kitchen and bathroom and some windows and spruce it up. But yeah, a lot of opportunity there.
Well, if you guys have any photos and you don't mind sharing them, I'd love to see them myself and post them, whether you got them on Facebook or somewhere I can post them on our website. So it's interesting to see the projects.
Yeah.
Especially once you get the before and after photos.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I took a video. I was over there taking a video tour the other day and I was walking through and, you know, the house is in bad shape. You know, it's falling over. So, you know, as I'm approaching the house, you know, instead of us opening the front door, I just step through the front window, right? You know,
wow. So it's,
no windows. So, but yeah, I did a pretty thorough before video. It'll be fun to see what it turns into after the fact.
Yeah. We're just into this project, so we don't know the end yet.
You don't know what surprises.
Hopefully it works out well, yeah.
What surprises lay beneath as you tear down,
right?
That's
right, that's right.
Cool. Well, guys, thank you so much. I mean, I know we're all taking notes, or any kind of final thoughts or data points we're throughout before we wrap things up?
I would just say to investors that are looking out there, it's still a great time, we think, to buy. You know, do I have to overpay is a question we hear a lot. And kind of yes. If you're going to buy, you're probably going to overpay right now, based upon the numbers. But from a long-term perspective, it still makes sense, we feel. We encourage investors to be cautious on the financing. You know, don't get in so far over your head that if the tenant doesn't make a rental payment, you suddenly can't make your mortgage payment. That's where you're going to get yourself in trouble. So be cautious on that. Be cautious on ensuring that the rental rate for the property is what you're going to get. You know, that's one of the things that we certainly offer to investors, whether they're clients of ours or not, is we're happy to prepare a rental analysis for them so they can get an idea as to what the property is going to be renting for.
And I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I know prices are high, but I always go back to like, where else can I put my money? The stock market's high. It's also frothy right now. Like, I mean, everything's high right
That's
now.
Right.
It seems like, where do you put your money?
That's
and
right.
I think mm-hmm. I agree with what we said a few minutes ago. Like if you buy somewhere in Denver in 30 years, I think it'll be worth a few more dollars than it is today.
You agree?
Absolutely.
Well, guys, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. I look forward to doing more of these episodes in the future.
Yeah, Chris.
Absolutely. If anybody has any questions, best way to reach us is just our website, which is rentgrace.com. Mm-hmm.